Okay, Boca Tov to everybody. I imagine there'll be people slipping in, but I want to begin because I have exactly 1 hour and I don't want to get between you and lunch. That would be a big mistake. I put texts on the chairs. I'm actually short, just a few texts. There are 30 copies, but just grab one from somebody where somebody's not sitting. So I'm going to give a very brief introduction to these five texts that you have in front of you and tell you that this is a project I'm working on right now. This is research in progress. I put my email address at the top of the handout. So should you come across any materials in the future that you believe will assist me in what I'm trying to do, just send me the text or the reference by email. So what is it that we're going to be looking at today? We know the two major genres of material in the Talmud. We call them, of course, halakha and agadah, and you all know how much time the Talmud spends on halakha. I think you're also familiar with the fact that there's a lot of agadah in the Talmud. Agadah encompasses many different kinds of materials, but let me just say that for my purposes today, I'm going to call agadah, one part of agadah is long stories about rabbis, narratives about rabbis. You know, Tanur Shalochnai, when Moshe came to the Beit Midrash of Bekiva and so on. So I'm not going to be dealing today with those stories, and I'm not going to be dealing today with halakha per se. In the course of my work of recent years, I've been looking to tease women's voices, or at least details about women's lives, social history of women in the Talmudic period. I've been trying to tease those kinds of details out of the text of the Talmud, but I've run into a little bit of a wall. There isn't, what I would say, enough material for me to put together something that is makes sense. But what I did come across in these searches of mine is a strand of Talmudic material which I'm going to argue, well, this is not my main point, I'm going to argue is neither halakha, because it's not prescriptive, nor is it agadah, because it's not long stories about rabbis. But I came across, and you're familiar with these things, I'm sure, what I'm going to call halachic episodes or halachic anecdotes. 2-3 lines. The way it generally works is a halakha stated, you know, okay, there's a mishnah at the beginning, and then there's some discussion of the mishnah, and then I see that the texts are disappearing rapidly. Hi, Geza. If there are no more texts, just sit next to somebody who has a text. So a halakha is stated, and then, not always, but frequently, there'll be a brief statement about how Rabbi so-and-so implemented, performed, executed that halakha. And that's it, and then you move on. Now, people have looked at these little episodes before, and the general consensus is, oh, the reason that the editor of the Talmud, or editors or redactors, whatever you want to call them, included these mini, mini episodes about particular rabbis is to show you how pious rabbis back then were, how they carried out the halakha meticulously, exactly as stated. And, yeah, somebody's over there, it's Jonathan over there, is already smiling, because you know where I'm headed. So, yeah, I mean, you're guessing, I'm sure, correctly where I'm headed. Anyway, I began bumping into these little episodes and looking at them and trying to figure out what they're saying. And the more I looked at them, independently of Rashi, Tosafot, and other medieval commentators, which I consult, but I don't allow those individuals to limit me in what I think, the more I looked at these anecdotes, the more I discovered that what these rabbis in the Talmud are doing, the little episodes about these rabbis, is that they are deviating from halakha, that they are changing halakha. I know this is grist for our mill, and this makes us all feel very good. Let me just step back a moment and say, Why have other people not come across this particular understanding of these episodes in the past? Because we all have our biases, and I think the biases of the commentators of the past was to make these rabbis out to be saints. And you can actually find the expression saintly rabbis in Sansino translation and elsewhere. But being a conservative Jew, and, you know, Chotamo Shel Kadosh Baruch Hu Emet, I allowed myself to examine these episodes with as open a mind as I possibly could. And I discovered what pleased me very much, which is that halakha, as halakha exits the Beit Midrash, you could say, oh, that's the final version, it's going to get written up in the codes. Well, no. It turns out that a very shrewd editor, it seems to me, you'll manage if you share text with somebody else, it seems to me that a very shrewd editor included many of these small episodes in order to say it's not that simple. It's like if we're sitting around like this in a Beit Midrash and then we decide on something and send it out there to the people, it could very well be that when the people implement this wonderful halakha that we have thought through so carefully among ourselves, it could very well be that the people discover it doesn't quite work. Now, I'm not saying they overturned the halakha, but that they tweaked it a little bit, they changed a little bit. That is my introduction. And Menachem, you're late, so you missed the introduction. You'll have to figure it out from the... I love to do this. Okay, so, and there aren't enough handouts. I'm very sorry about that. I was told to make 30. I should have made 50. Okay, so we're going to look at five instances of this phenomenon in the Talmud, and hopefully in your studies you will find more. By the way, if you find a counterexample, I'm open to counterexamples too. I'm not saying that every one of these fits this theory that I'm proposing, but surely if you find examples which are consistent with what I'm saying, I'm happy to look at them too. Okay, I'm going to number one. So the context here is you're not allowed to heal on Shabbat. And Mar Ukva, who's an Amora from Eretz Yisrael, says that if you bang up or knock up your hand or your foot, what you can do on Shabbat, because it's not going to be considered refuah, is you can soak it in wine or apply wine to the bruise, because wine will reduce the swelling. I don't know if that's medically sound or not, but you don't cross the line of refuah b'Shabbat by applying wine or soaking your foot or your hand in wine. Ibailaho. So then they pondered, meaning people in the Beit Midrash asked a very logical next question. Chala, my chala is not chala that we know today. Chet laman aleph is vinegar, which you know wine can turn into vinegar. So the question is, can you apply vinegar to a bruise on the Sabbath? And you might say to yourself, wait a second, if we're talking about wine, why are we now talking about vinegar? Either they're the same or if they're not the same. The idea being that you cross the line. Wine is not medicine. Wine is a drink. But vinegar has medicinal properties. So can you, if we can use wine on Shabbat to assist us, can you also use vinegar? Amar Rav Hillel, Rav Ashi, ki havina be Rav Kahana, amrei chalalo. So here, Rav Hillel, whom you probably don't hear very much about, this is not the famous Hillel and the Tana, it's an Amora, it was a sixth generation contemporary of Rav Ashi. One rabbi says to the other, when I was at the home of the Beit Midrash, bay is a word which has many different meanings, let's not talk about it quite now. When I was with Rav Kahana, they said, chalalo, meaning, no, we may not use vinegar on Shabbat to reduce the swelling, because that's already healing on Shabbat. Amar Rava, v'hani b'nei mechoza, kevan demafanke, afilu charma name. And Rava has a few choice tidbits. Again, the people coming in now, you don't have handouts, try to share with somebody. I'm sorry, you may not have chairs either. So Rava, who knew the people of Mechoza very well, says the pampered people of Mechoza, for them, because they're so pampered, even wine has a sufficient amount of, I don't know, acidity or vinegar-like qualities. It will heal them on Shabbat, meaning the people of Mechoza cannot use wine on Shabbat. Whereas the rest of the world can, the people of Mechoza can't. Now we come to our anecdote. Oh, and I don't think I mentioned yet. What I tried to do in my search for anecdotes is to be as objective as I could, because what I might call a short legal anecdote, you might not call a short legal anecdote. So I took the, I found that a lot of these anecdotes had the word ikla in them, aleph yud kuf lamed, I, bolded it, underlining it. It means dropped in on, visited, and so on. The translations sometimes say visited, sometimes say happened to be there. It doesn't matter for my purposes. I'm just translating it as visited. Ravina ikla levei Rav Ashi. So Ravina visits Rav Ashi. Ravina is slightly junior to Rav Ashi. Chazyeh didricha lechamra agava tekar. And he saw, and this is on Shabbat, these rabbis, by the way, often seem to be visiting one another, which I find interesting. I don't know what to make of that. But in particular, rabbis seem to be visiting other rabbis to spend Shabbat with them. So here is Ravina spending Shabbat with Rav Ashi, and he sees that Rav Ashi, dricha lechamra, chamra is chamor, that a donkey or an ass, whatever the translation is, what I write here, an ass, had an ass had trodden on the back of his foot, kar'e, v'yativ katsam le'bechala, and Ravina sees Rav Ashi soaking his foot in vinegar, apparently to reduce the swelling. And Ravina says to Rav Ashi, Amar le lo savar la mar, lahadi amar Rav Hillel chavalo. He challenges Rav Ashi by saying the following, doesn't the master, he's referring to his senior colleague as master here, doesn't the master hold what Rav Hillel said, meaning we saw that a few lines above, which is chalalo, no, you can't use vinegar on Shabbat. I hope you understand the audacity of what's going on here. Yes, there aren't enough handouts. You can sit on the floor, you can share handouts. I'm really sorry. Okay, so the thing here is, rabbis visit each other, as I already mentioned, and rabbis criticize each other. This is a side issue, but let me just mention it because it fascinates me. There is a culture of criticism in particular. Yonina, you find that funny. Okay, so do I. But there is a culture of criticism in the Babylonian Talmud. Invariably, and I'm stressing the word invariably, when you see the word iklah, the one rabbi visited another, you will almost always find that either the visiting rabbi criticizes the host, halachic behavior, or the host is going to criticize the visitor's halachic behavior, or somebody in the home of the host is going to criticize the visitor's behavior. Now, that never happens to us, of course. Yeah. All right. So, what's happening here is Ravina is shocked that Rav Ashi is using vinegar as medicine for his wound on Shabbat, even though a recent rabbinic opinion stated that vinegar is healing on Shabbat and you shouldn't be doing it. And now comes Rav Ashi's answer, Amarle, Gav Hayad, the Gav Haregel, Shane, which means a swelling on the back of the hand or the back of the foot is different. All right? I was hoping, I heard one snicker around here. I was hoping for a few more snickers. Okay, just to make sure that my the impact of this story is not lost on you is as follows. So I have a little granddaughter in Washington, D.C., and I recently visited, and she was jumping on the bed on Friday night, and I said to her as sweetly as I can, because I'm the grandmother and I don't see my job as disciplining, I said, I think your parents don't allow you to jump on the bed. And she said, 3 years old, I'm not jumping, I'm running. on the bed. Okay. So, in other words, this rabbi, Rav Ashi, is defending his behavior by saying, oh, I'm not supposed to use vinegar on Shabbat, not on my face, not on my stomach, but the back, he has a wound on his foot, back of my foot, that's different. That's okay. I take the halachic prerogative, I, Rav Ashi, to violate the words of Rav Hillel, which we assume he knew, because actually what it says above is Rav Hillel said this to Rav Ashi. All right, so he can't claim ignorance of the law. Anyway, this is my first example of a small anecdote. The halacha has been stated, and what does the rabbi do? The rabbi behaves in ways that meet his own personal needs. He's suffering with some kind of wound, and he knows vinegar is going to do more for him than wine, so he applies vinegar on Shabbat. All right, let's skip number two for the moment, because number three is even clearer, and we'll come back to number two. Another example, it happens to involve Ravina as well, and here the context, this is the last chapter of Baba Kama, and the context is how to avoid even the appearance of robbery or something like robbery, stay away from it. All right, Tan Rabbanan, we have a Braita, Lokhim min ha-nashim, klei tzemer b'yehuda, klei pishtan v'galil, avaloye not rishmani mislato. So, Lokhim here means to purchase. One is allowed to purchase from women. See, there was such a thing as a cottage industry in the days of the Talmud. Maybe women had booths in the marketplace. I can't tell you that I know about that as correct or incorrect, but there are enough references in the Talmud for me to say a woman who had extra wool or, you know, some leftover wool or whatever, she could make it into something, klei tzemer, and she could sell it from the doorway of her home or a linen. Depending on her location, these are likely products. But she may not sell wine or oil or fine flour because those are her husband's main agricultural products. And if she's selling them at the door of her house and pocketing the money, then she's taking from, she's stealing from her husband. Therefore, you shouldn't buy these things from her because she'd be stealing from her husband and you'd be stealing from her husband too if you bought them. But these other things you can buy for her. Abba Shaul Amir, Mocher Isha Ba'arba'a V'chamisha Dinar Kedei La'asot Kippa L'Rosha. I included this for that charming detail. So Abba Shaul says, a woman may sell things, you know, for a small amount of money, for 4 or 5 dinarim. Dinar is like a dollar. Why does a woman need money? Why does a woman sell things at the door of her home to raise some petty cash for herself? Kedei La'asot Kippa L'Rosha. So that she can get a hat for her head. And now you see that the original wearers of kippah were women. All right? And this is not the only reference in the Talmud to kippah as being a hat for a woman, because it's a dome. So, again, I'd like to point out that when I was a child, I used to go with my mother to the millinery shop, and you'd begin with a hat, which was just like something that hugged the head. You'd add a flower, you'd add a feather, you'd add a ribbon, and that's the way it worked. So her kippah, I don't think it's like our kippah exactly, but it's like a skull cap would be a really excellent translation. But now comes along that we need. So here we have somebody collecting for charity, and we're talking about, can charity collectors, now we're all in the fundraising business, can charity collectors accept donations from women, or would it be stealing? Would she be giving away her husband's money without her husband's consent? And the answer is, you can accept davar mu'at, a small donation from a woman, but avalo davar mu'at, but not a large donation, because, again, that would be stealing from her husband. Now, the story. Ravina ikla leve machoza. So this sixth generation Babylonian Mara visits, I don't know if it's Be Machoza, is a suburb of Machoza or part of Machoza, but Machoza is a big city, a town, whatever. Atu nashe de Be Machoza ramu kame kavle v'shire. So the women of Machoza, now he probably held some kind of parlor meeting, and a lot of women show up, and what do they do when he gives his pitch? I don't know what charity he was raising money for, but whichever it was, he gives a pitch, and what do the women do? They throw down on the ground in front of him, meaning towards him, chains and necklaces. They take off their jewelry. Now, we, of course, remember women take off their jewelry for the egel. Egel has a hav. But here we have women giving their jewelry for whatever good cause that Ravina is raising money for. Kabil minayhu, and the anecdote says, he accepted these donations from the women, the necklaces and the chains and so on, which we probably should assume made out of gold or silver or semi-precious. Amrale rabatos father Ravina. So Ravina has a junior colleague who says to him, and you know the criticism is coming, and here's the way you criticize your teacher. You don't just say, how could you do such a thing? Or you are violating Jewish law. I think we saw the same kind of polite behavior above. Well, yeah, we did sort of, but here's even clearer. So his junior colleague says to him, Vatanya, but we learned in a brighter, the one that you just saw, Mekablim mehem devar mu'at avalo devar merubeh, meaning, Rabbi, how can you accept jewelry from women? That is a large donation, Rabbi, and the brighter states very clearly you can only take a small donation from women. Now, we're going to turn, my handout is different. Okay, I have the answer on the next page. If there were more time, I would ask you to think of this answer on your own, but I'm not going to ask you that. Amarle, hani livne machoza davar mu'at ninu. Okay? Yeah. Spoken like a true fundraiser, right? You accept donations, and if there's any question as to the legitimacy of the donation, I'm standing in the library, and we know there was an issue with the, many years ago, with the, with the donor of this library. But in rare cases...
It was a large donation.
Yes. And it's from bad. Yeah. So here again, this is just like, no, I'm not jumping, I'm running. He's saying, hey, for these people, this is only a small donation. He has taken the words, davar mu'at in the brayta, and interpreted them in a relative way. Oh yeah, depending on where I'm raising money, davar mu'at is going to change in its meaning. So, if you were a medieval commentator, okay, it just occurs to me, I could have should have brought you some medieval commentary on this, but I'm going to guess that a medieval commentator would not be standing here interpreting the story the way I just interpreted with a straight face. The medieval commentator would say, but that's exactly what the Breitel was talking about. And I'm standing here and telling you, no, I don't think that's what the Breitel was talking about. The Breitel was making a clear statement that women are suspect of giving away their husband's property, therefore watch out what you buy or what you accept as donations from women. And Ravina has decided to make his own decisions with regard to that particular halakha. Okay, so now let's go back to number two, which is a very famous sugya, and particularly because it was made famous recently by Ruth Calderon in the book that she wrote, A Bride for the Night. I was teaching my rabbinical students this semester a course called Family Relations, and I hadn't intended on including this particular sugya that we're going to look at right now, and then one of them asked me about it, and I said, oh, that's a good idea. Why don't we look at this sugya too? And we just looked at it yesterday. It was the last sugya of the semester. So I'm sure you're all familiar with the one famous line here, but we're going to look at that line in context. Titania, so what's the concern in Bavli of Amot 37b? They're talking there about lineage and possible mamzei root, depending on the nature of the relationship of the parents and so on. That's their general concern. And here's some more immediate context. Titania, and Breita, we learn Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov Amer, Haresha Baal Nashim Harbeb, En Yodeo Eza Mehem Ba. If a man has sex with many women and he doesn't know, doesn't remember the names of or the identities of all the women with whom he had sex, this is not marriage. V'chein Hisha Baal Aleha Anashim Harbeb, En Yodat Me Eza Mehem Kimbla. Similarly, a woman who has sex with many men, again, outside of marriage, she's not necessarily a married woman, and she's having sex with many different men, and she doesn't even know who is the father of the child that she then ultimately bears. Nimtza, what's going to happen, this is Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, the Tana, preaching against this behavior, obviously. If you do this, Nimtza, avno seit bito, v'achno seit achoto. So if she has a child, let me back up a minute. If he has sex with a woman in Los Angeles and then with a woman in Austin, and each of those women bears a child, those children might, and one is a boy, one is a girl, those two children might grow up and not knowing the identity of their father because the mother doesn't even know from which man she was impregnated. These children might wind up marrying each other, and that would be a brother marrying a sister, at least half, right, and half sibling. And then v'nit malei kol olam kulo mamzerim, and this is how we multiply mamzerim in the world. V'alzeh ne'amar umala haaretz zima. So it's a quote from Vayikra that the land will be filled with lewdness. This is from that chapter where we actually have v'yahavta l'recha kamocha. Then he goes on, and he yater al kein amar Rebbe Elazar ben Yaakov, same Tana, goes a step further and says, "Lo yisa adam isha b'mdina zo v'yalech v'isa isha b'mdina acheret." A man should not marry a woman in this town or a province and then go and take a second wife in a different province. Shema yizdav guzel azeh. Now, these Tanakh texts are famous for not giving you the antecedents that you need to understand them. So when it says, lest they couple with each other, we're talking about the offspring. He has offspring with the wife in this town, offspring with a wife in that town, and then these children grow up, lest they have sex with each other. So even if the children are not born out of wedlock, even if they are born out of marriage, says Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, this is not a good idea. So well, obviously he's preaching is stay home with your one wife, and that way those children will grow up, they'll know you as their father, and we will not wind up with incestuous relationships that produce mamzerim. But now the Gemara comes with that famous line, "Ini." So is that so? The Gemara challenges what was just stated. Don't go and marry a woman here and a woman there, and so on. And is that so? V'ha Rav ki ikla l'dar dashir machriz v'yamar man hav l'yoma v'Rav Nachman ki ikla l'shech natziv machriz v'yamar man hav l'yoma. Now, before I translate this, can I just get a show of hands? Who is familiar with this famous line, the bride for a night line? You know, in other words, you all knew this, right? Before today, this is very famous. But we're looking at it in context. So Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov said, not a good idea to have multiple wives. And now the Gemara says, the anonymous voice, the Stamma de Gemara says, but we know that Rav is Babylonian Mora, very prominent first generation, when he visited this town, Dardashir, in Babylonia, he would announce and say, now the words man havya lioma simply mean who, man is who, havya will be, or perhaps is, it could be present tense, who will be lioma, for the day. All right? That apparently means, okay, since, and then Rav Nachman did the same thing when he visited Shech Netziv, he would say, who will be for the day? Okay, the commentators agree, and I would certainly agree with the commentators, given the context in which this very small episode about Rav and the other one about Rav Nachman, given the context in which they appear right after Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov's statement that you shouldn't marry a wife here and a wife there, it looks like Rav and Rav Nachman, when they're on business trips, teaching trips, I don't know, real estate shopping trips, whatever it is that they're doing, they're away from home, and they, okay, I'm going to have a little bit more to say on this, and they want to have sex on the road, okay? The wife is not with them. The wife is home, probably taking care of whatever kids they already have, or doing other things that women do in those days, baking bread, doing laundry, and so on.
Giving away the jewelry.
They're what?
Giving away the jewelry.
Oh, yes, giving away the jewelry. That's excellent. So when he's on the road, you're going to give away the jewelry. Yes, yes. Very nice connection. So Rob says, I need a woman for, I'll use the word tonight rather than today. Yoma means day, but 24 hours. I need a woman for tonight. And so the Gemara, in other words, please understand, this means how could Rav have a wife at home and then take a wife for a day on a business trip or on some kind of trip, and then she could get pregnant, the wife in Dardashir, and the child will grow up and not really know who his father is, because Rav is just staying there, apparently one day, although I'll tell you in a moment what Rashi says, and that child could grow up and then, without realizing it, marry a different child of Rav. They grew up in where Rav lives. I forget where. I don't remember where Rav lives. Surah. So the Gemara is saying, doesn't this go against what Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov said? And they say the same thing about Rav Nachman. And now comes the answer, Shani Rabbanan de Pekia Shmaihu. So I'm going to translate that in a moment, but my students yesterday loved this. Okay, this means, I'm making fun of my students, you'll forgive me. This means rabbis are in a different category. Dipikia, meaning it's perfectly okay for a rabbi, not for an ordinary man, but for a rabbi to find a wife for a day on the road because he's got sexual needs, that's perfectly okay. And then you say, but wait a second, won't it lead ultimately next generation to incest? And the answer is pikia. Pikia is the pei becomes a bet and the ayin becomes an aleph, is baki shmaihu. Their names are known. Meaning, he's not going to raise the child that he fathers in Dardashir with the wife for the day. He's not going to raise that child. But people will apparently call that child when the mother gets pregnant and the community knows that she had sex for one night with this visiting rabbi. Okay, you got to fill in all these details. The community is going to identify that child, says the Gemara here, as the child is Rav. So yes, Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, the Tana, is correct in saying you shouldn't have two wives in different places lest it ultimately lead to incest of mamzerim, but rabbis, it's okay for rabbis to have sex on the road, because should a pregnancy result and a birth result and he doesn't raise his own child, people will still know that the child is his. Now, I just want to point out, this is a little different from the two stories we looked at a moment ago, because in this case, it's not Rav himself or Rav Nachman himself justifying his behavior. It's the Stamma de Gemara justifying the behavior. In other words, the way the sugya is presented is you have the Braita of Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov with Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov's statement. Then you have apparently the Stamma de Gemara saying, but we have two Amoraim who did take wives on the road, and doesn't that produce mamzerim, and shouldn't they not be allowed to do such a thing? And then Stama de Gemara, same person, different person, doesn't matter, says, don't worry, it won't lead to mamzerim. It's perfectly okay for these rabbis to do as they please when they're on the road. So again, what I'm trying to point out here is we just saw the development of a new halakha, or you could say a limitation. Yes, of course, Rabbi Ezra ben Yaakov is 100% right. We don't want people doing that. But we're going to carve out the exception for rabbis. And so this is the thing that, before I read the rest of the sugya. So earlier in the semester...
Just for famous rabbis. Just for well-known rabbis.
You are limiting... Don't limit the limitation.
God says, Yishmael, the name is known.
Well, it depends. It doesn't mean that the rabbi is famous. It just means that the child will be identified as the child of the visiting rabbi. Otherwise, we'd have to get into a discussion of who's famous and who's not. Is that Melissa back there?
You tried.
This presupposes that the rabbi wants it to be known that he has had sex outside the marriage and wants the child to be known...
as his. Yes, well.
He's coming to town and announcing.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear what?
He came to town and he announced.
Oh, yes.
Quiet for while I'm here.
Yes, he did come to town and announce. Yes, by the way, I personally am not even convinced that when he says man hav liyoma, he's talking about marriage. Now, the commentators, I got to tell you about Rashi, and I've got to something else my students said, but the commentators immediately assume the following, and it's not in the text. It's just simply not in the text. The commentators immediately assume that what he's doing, okay, that he married her, you could say, is the context, because it's being brought in conjunction with Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov's statement, don't marry. But it doesn't say that there's a ketubah, and it doesn't say that he's immediately going to divorce her, and it doesn't say that she's his wife for only one day. All of those details are added in by the commentators. Let's see, I'm trying to think for what reason that could be. I don't know, just to make sense of who will be my wife for a day. Yes?
For a very simple reason. There was no prohibition against multiple wives in the Gemara. It's not until the Middle Ages when it becomes normative. In Christian Europe.
Okay, that may be true, but we do have this brighter. Again, I think context is extremely important. We have Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov saying, don't do this. And by the way, his statement also appears in Tosefta Kiddushin in the first chapter, where, again, addressing your point, we know that adultery is defined in Jewish law, or rabbinic law, as... A married woman, adultery is when a man has sex with another man's wife. It's not his own status that matters, it's her status that matters. So Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov is going further. In other words, you're right that there's no halachic ban on a man having more than one wife in different places because he's marrying each one of them. It's not adultery, etc., etc. But Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov is preaching. He's sermonizing and saying, lo yisa, don't do it because it's going to lead down the road to mamzerut. And then, so then the Gemara says, but these rabbis were doing it. All right? And again, so it's not that they were... It's not breaking the law. It's going against the good advice that Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov was giving. So the thing I want to say about what my students reminded me of when we studied this is you're probably familiar with the stories in Ketubot 62b and 63a about these rabbis who left home for 6 months, for 12 months, for 3 years, for 6 years, for 12 years, all right? And the context of those stories happens to be the conjugal rights of the wife. The Mishnah that precedes those stories is all about a wife's conjugal rights, the demands that she can make on her husband, conjugally speaking. So it's interesting that with the approval of the Babylonian Talmud of long absences to study Torah, we then find these two rabbis who... I don't know how long that business trip is, but here they are in this city. I don't know if they're on the road for a month or a week or whatever it is, but they need to have sex when they're on the road, which kind of flies in the face of all that nobility of oh, when I'm studying Torah, even on Yom Kippur, this one story, I'm not going to go home to my wife, etc., etc. So it's hard to put all these things together. And I thought that was a very nice comment of my students. So let me continue. There's a little bit more to the sugya. V'ha'amar Rava. So the Gemara has just said it's okay for rabbis to do this. And now there's a second objection. V'ha'amar Rava, t'va'u halina say, when a woman is summoned to get married, v'nit paisa, that's like the word appease, and she agrees to the marriage. Tzrichah leishev shiva nikiyim. A woman cannot be proposed to on Monday in the morning and get married Monday night. She needs to observe a 7 white days. In other words, we got to make sure that there's no menstrual blood, and that for the 7 days prior to the marriage and dipping in the mikveh, then she's ready to get married. So how could these rabbis come to town and say, man hav leyoma, that goes against what Rava said, that a woman needs at least 7 days after she agrees to the marriage to prepare herself for the marriage. And now the Stama Gemara gives another very interesting answer. Rabbanan, shluchayu hava mishadre umode leho. Rabbis would send their shlichim, rabbis would send mishadre, they would send messengers and inform them. Inform whom? Inform the women. In other words, if the rabbi, today is April 28th, okay? So a bunch of you are not home, all right? A week ago, on April 21st, you would have had a messenger arrive in New York City and say, on the 28th of April, so-and-so rabbi is coming to town, and he's going to say, man hav leyoma, I'm looking for a woman on April 21st who will agree to be his wife for a night on April 28th. And his shaliach would find such a woman, and she would have her 7 white days, clean days, no menstrual blood, and then on the 28th, rabbi shows up and they would marry. Do you realize this totally undermines the simple meaning of the words man hav leyoma? It said, and the line there, when Rav arrived in Dardashir, he would announce publicly and say, who will be with me for the night? As they had married or not married, but whatever. So, but you see, but the Gemara must keep supporting the image of the rabbi, and that's what the Gemara says. And now I'll read you the last line, and then we have 2 more stories to look at. V'bayit Ema, here's an alternative explanation of how he could marry her in one day without the 7-day preparation. L'rabbanan, Yehudei ba'alma hu demiachadele, diamar mar eno dome mi sheyesh lo pat besalo, v'mi sheeno pat besalo. Meaning, it's like saying, you know, you people, you just got it all wrong. These rabbis were not having sex for the, you know, one night with this woman. They were simply secluding themselves privately. The translation here is, I took it from Sansino, they had the women in their private rooms. That apparently was enough to satisfy, according to this. This, according to this Stama de Gemara, it satisfied the rabbi's sexual urge merely to have the woman alone with him in a room. On the bed, I don't know. On the chair, I don't know. On the floor, I can't tell you anything. But that's the answer that's given here, because we, and by the way, so why, what is the importance of this answer? That's why you don't need 7 days of preparation. If they were going to have sex, she needs 7 days of preparation. But if they're not going to have sex, they're just going to have yichud. Now, again, my student said to me yesterday, but didn't we learn a few weeks ago that famous mission at the end of Kiddushim, lo yitecheid ish im shtei nashim. A man is not allowed to be alone in a room with 2 women. For sure, a man is not allowed to be alone in a room with 1 woman who's not his wife. Obviously his wife, yes. But not with a woman, not his wife. And here are the commentators go crazy trying to figure out how this could be. And there's this very charming statement here, which the Ritva says he has no idea how this works. And let me tell you what it says. Somebody who has bread in his basket. If you are hungry, that's the idea here, sexually hungry, and now we'll talk about physical hunger. If you are hungry, it's very different if you have bread in your basket than if you don't have bread in your basket. Okay? Apparently meaning, on Yom Kippur, if you know you're going home, you're hungry on Yom Kippur, if you know you're going home to a breakfast, you're going to manage very nicely to get through the day and not have tremendous anxiety. But if you are hungry and you're poor and you don't know where your next meal is coming from, that's a much, I'm not talking personally because I never experienced it, but it makes sense to me. If you don't know where your next meal is coming from, you're going to have a much greater anxiety and fear for the future and so on. You're going to suffer a lot more. So the Ritva says he has no idea how that particular line applies to men who are having a woman be there with them but not have sex with her and so on and so on. And Ritva actually says that in certain manuscripts, this whole Ibayit Ema line doesn't appear. And that's one way of solving a problem when you don't understand how something works. Okay, so what we've seen, I'll call on you 1 second. What we've seen so far is 3 instances in which a halakha is innovated. In the first case, he said, I'm going to use vinegar on Shabbat because the back of the hand and the back of the foot is different. In the second case, he said small donations means even big donations from rich people. And in this case, it's, the rabbis, we don't apply. For rabbis, we've carved out an exception from the statement of Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov. Jerry?
Yeah, this is a different context to this discussion, not the sexual context, but by coincidence, I'm going to be teaching the first parak of Psachim, mm-hmm. and in an intertextual analysis sense, there is a sukkah there that also deals with B'nai Machoza.
Yes.
Of whether or not you're required to give hektesh from cattle and from dough that the Romans were taking arnona from.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the opinions are that dough you are required, but cattle you're not required because cattle, like the rabbis, there's buzz about them. When they have a baby, it's the same kind of issue of mm-hmm. there being a public dimension. And mm-hmm. it's also related to B'nai Machoza.
It
just strikes me that it's a kind of unusual association.
Well, the B'nai Machoza are known throughout the Talmud, it's a little bit like New York City, as being, Machoza is a metropolitan area, the B'nai Machoza are assumed to be wealthy, but the women of Machoza come in for a particular, and they're all considered lazy and pampered and whatnot, and the women of Machoza are assaulted, cursed in a number of different places in the Talmud, even more so than the men. So yes, Machoza seems to be unto itself. Yes, that's true. Okay, yes.
Do you have a sense that the justification for the rabbi's behavior was really an integral part of the story, or was it added later to justify?
Yeah, so I'm definitely going in with the later. I think you had Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov in the Braita, that's here in the Sugya and elsewhere, and then you have the episodes saying, and these rabbis didn't abide by what he's saying, period. And then the Stamat de Gemara couldn't live with the fact that these two things clashed with each other, and then you get that whole chain of, their names are well known, but what about 7 clean days? Well, they sent their messages and so on. In Ruth Calderon's book, she doesn't distinguish between. I'm not criticizing her. I actually think she has a very fine take on this episode. And she named her book A Bride for the Night after this episode. She puts into her story the fact that the rabbis' names are known, the fact that they send their messengers in advance, and that a woman has to be prepared 7 days, and so on and so on. But no, I'm convinced that the episodes stand on their own 2 feet, and you've got a clash between the episode and the Braita.
And later stuff.
Yeah, that's interesting. Okay, so let's move on. I have, 17 minutes left. Let's do these last 2 episodes, which are a little bit different, and then I'm happy to have more give and take. And I try very hard, by the way, where I can, not always, is to bring a woman, have an episode be about a woman. So this is number 4. This is Yerushalmi. It doesn't have the word ikla, because the word ikla does not appear in the Yerushalmi. But as you see, I underline salak legabe, which means he went up to or he entered. Same thing as visited. Okay, Tani Rabbi Chia, aval mistakel hu masha bakos hu masha bakarabe no choshesh. Okay, we're here talking about Shabbat lamps. and you're not supposed to read by the light of the Shabbat lamp. It's not like Hanukkah lamps. It's not that they're Kodesh. You don't read by the light of the Shabbat lamp. Shema Yateh, okay? This is a wonderful thing, because if you tilt that oil lamp, if you don't use good oils and good wicks, and the flame starts sputtering, and you are trying to read, or you're trying to, have a conversation, wash dishes, whatever it is, and the light is sputtering, you're going to tilt that lamp to get the oil drawn up better in the wick, and that's already considered Chilul Shabbat. That's a Mavir Esh B'Shabbat. So that's the context of the story. So the question is, what are we allowed to do by the light of the candles that won't lead us to tilt it, and what are we not allowed to do? That's the general context. So Rabbi Chia, whose transition generation from Tani to Gemarek period, he says, Mr. Kilhu Bakos, you are allowed to pick up a glass and look to see what's inside it, or pick up a bowl, umasha bakera, they know choshesh, and you don't worry if you engage in these particular actions that you're going to be violating Shabbat, you're going to be led to tilt the candle. No, it's perfectly okay. And by the way, why might you be picking up a bowl or a glass? And here, I do have to rely on the commentators, and they say to check that it's clean. Otherwise, you're sitting at somebody's table, and they're about to pour you wine into this glass, and you just pick up the glass and hold it in front of the candle to make sure, I don't know, there are no dead bugs in it, or that it was washed, or whatever. So this is, according to Rabbi Chia, this is perfectly allowed on Shabbat. Rav Yirmiya Salak Lagabei. Now you see that next word, Resh Bet Samach Yud, that's Rav Asi. But in, it's like I'm gonna eat, like G-O-N-N-A. There's a tendency when you speak the language to contract. So Rav Yirmiya visits Rav Asi. Rav Yirmiya is a slightly junior colleague to Rav Asi. Mazak Lekasa. So the host pours a cup of wine for the guest. Shari Mistakel Bey, and he begins, Shari here means to begin, he begins examining the glass. That is to say, the host, who is Rav Asi, pours the wine, and then the guest starts examining the cup by the light of the candle, which we just heard from Rabbi Chia is perfectly legitimate, perfectly allowed on Shabbat. Amrale b'nei beite. Now this is an amazing phrase in and of itself. Let's look at the phrase before. Amrale is she said to him, and you know that the syntax in Aramaic and in Hebrew is you sometimes have the verb before the subject, the predicate precedes the subject. So b'nei beite is feminine, and she said to him, and you know what b'nei beite is. Do not translate it as members of the household, which is the literal translation of b'nei beite. B'nei beite here has to mean his wife. And I can tell you, Lieberman, our own Saul Lieberman, Alav HaShalom, has written on this, and others have written on it, the expression b'nei beite in Jerusalem Talmud and Babylonian Talmud means the wife. Because you know there's another word for wife in Aramaic, debitu, dalet bet yud tuf hey vav, of his house. So b'nei beite, debitu, it's basically all the same. Even inshe beite, the people of the house is a reference to the wife. I can't say more than that because I have nothing more to say, except it's important to note that this is how she is referred to, and she is at the table, either eating or serving, I don't know for sure. She's at the table, and she speaks up and says, Chami mahu avid. Chami is tir'eh. Take a look. Take a look at what he's doing. Meaning, she sees the guest examining the glass by the light of the Shabbat lamp, and she says to her husband, I will assume, but probably in the earshot of the guest, oh my God, he is violating Shabbat. That's what she's saying, meaning that in her home, it apparently is clear that, and I know this from Babylonian Talmud as well, you're not allowed to read one Talmud through the eyes of the other, but, okay, she apparently has been taught by her husband, and this is a halakha on its way out of the Beit Midrash. It's not yet established halakha. Rabbi Chia is saying, not the husband, Rabbi Chia is saying, you may examine a glass by the light of the Shabbat lamp, and she apparently knows that in her home, her husband, Rav Asi, does not allow one on Shabbat to examine a glass by the light of the lamp, again, perhaps for Shema Yateh. So she's upset. I mean, I'd be upset too. What if a guest came to my house and on Shabbat lit a cigarette, let alone the fact that I wouldn't allow smoking at any time? But what if somebody comes into my house? People have come into my house and started knitting on Shabbat and so on. You know, it's always a question, what am I going to do? Am I going to say something? Am I not going to say something? But she speaks up. First of all, I love that. We've got her voice preserved. Her voice is knowledgeable. She knows. This is not what I would call the main precept of Jewish law. This is, subsidiary Jewish law. She knows from her husband, who disagrees with Rabbi Chiya, that you're not allowed to do this in the house. And she's at the table, and the guy is doing it, and she says, look what he's doing. Amar la, so her husband says to her, Duhu nahud b'shita tederabo, meaning, quiet down, wife. He, our guest, is practicing according to the method of his own rabbi. I wrote here, according to the teachings of his own rabbi. Meaning, Rav Asi knows that he holds one may not do this, but he knows that Rabbi Chiya holds that you may do this. So if a guest in the house is examining a cup by the light of the Shabbat lamp, he's saying to his wife, it's okay. This man, our guest, has a teacher who he is following, and let's not embarrass him, basically, is what he's saying. And then he just quotes it again, Detani Rabbi Chiya, Mistakelhu, Masha Bakosu, Masha Bekara, Ve'no Choshesh. So I'm not going to tell you that there's a new halacha emerging in the story, but the reason I included it is, first of all, I wanted something from the Talmud Yerushalmi, but I included it, and I also wanted it because of the woman's voice, but I included it because there was criticism. You come to somebody's house and you sit down at his Shabbat table and you just pick up a glass, and before you know it, somebody's telling you you've done the wrong thing. I mean, you picked up a glass to look at it in the light of the Shabbat candle. And in theory, depending on what the host said to his wife, perhaps a new halacha could have come out of this, but in this case, he's basically saying to her, there's a dispute, there's a halachic dispute, and the guest will do it his way, and we'll do it our way, and that's the end of it, and we must be tolerant of the people who visit us in our homes on Shabbat. I just want to point out, the halacha is not yet resolved. I'm not sure he would have been that accommodating to the guest if it had been resolved halacha, such as, don't light a match on Shabbat. Okay, and now we go to the last story here. V'yamar Rava Bar Machasya Amar Rav Chama Bar Guria Amar Rav Yafa Tanit L'Chalom Ka'esh L'Na'oret. So this is a halachic statement that a fast is good for a dream the way fire is for straw. Meaning, rabbis in those days were definitely into dream interpretation, and dreams often foretold things that were going to happen to you, which you didn't want to happen, difficult things that were going to happen to you. And what would you do if you woke up in the morning with this awful feeling that something bad is about to happen because you dreamed that it was going to happen? Ta'anit, you fast. And that, according to the rabbis, according to Rav, it's the same Rav we've been talking about before, if you fast, that will cancel, it will stop those predictions, those bad predictions from coming through. Amar Rav Chisda bo bayom. So Rav Chisda says, yeah, fast, but on that same day. You don't wake up with a bad dream on Monday morning and say, oh, I'll wait until Yom Kippur and fast. No, you wake up with a bad dream Monday morning, you fast on Monday or Tuesday or Wednesday or whatever. Ve'amar Rav Yosef, afilu b'Shabbat. Even if you wake up Shabbat morning having had a bad dream Friday night and you're not supposed to fast on Shabbat, you fast on Shabbat if you want to make sure to avert the evil tidings that the dream brought you. Rav Yehoshua Braid Rav Idi Ikla Levei Rav Ashi. All right, so here we have a fifth, sixth generation rabbi, Ikla. He visits the home of Rav Ashi. And yes, okay, I'll say something about Bay a little bit in a moment. Afdele Igla Tilta. They made for him. Now, the they is a little vague, and it means the household staff, because it's not Rav Ashi who's in the kitchen cooking. It's his wife and his household staff in the kitchen cooking. And Igla Tilta, nobody quite knows what it means. Igla is egel, a calf. Tilta, a third grown, 3 years old, the third born to its mother. We don't know, but why don't we just call it Chateaubriand, which is also tender and hard to come by and a delicacy. I think I had it in Israel once. Amrule. They said to him, now again, I have to comment on who the they is, but let's go through the story first. They said to him, Lit om mar midi, let the master taste midi, something, to have it, taste it. You know, we prepared this delicacy. I have to emphasize, Igla Tilta is a big deal in the Talmud. It's referred to in other places. We went out of our way and made you the special dish. You are our guest. Please taste it. Amar Laho, but he, this is Rabbi Yoshua, Bread Ravidi, says to them, B'ta'anit yativna, I am fasting, meaning I can't take a taste. Amrule, they said to him, V'lo sabarle mar lahad Rav Yudah, d'yamar Rav Yudah, lo ve'adam tanito pureya. And they remind him of a teaching. I have to comment on who the they is. I'll do so in just a moment. And they say to him, doesn't the master, don't you know the teaching of Rav Yudah, who said, you can borrow against the fast and pay back later. Meaning, if the fast falls, let's say, on Tuesday, today, and you're coming to New York to be part of an RA, and I gather there's some kind of dinner tonight or there's lunch, maybe you don't have to fast today, even though you should be fasting today for whatever reason. Fast next Tuesday. Lover, borrow against your fast, and you'll pay it back next week. So they say that to him, and then the final line is, Amar Laho Ta'anit Chalom Hu, I can't do that. I can't borrow against my fast and pay back later, because my fast is not because there's a drought in my town or something else. My fast is because I had a bad dream, and I won't repeat it, and you know, and he's basically telling them a fast can avert the predictions of a bad dream, and you've got to do it the same day and even on Shabbat. So now, there's no new halakha coming out here, but let's just take a little look at this. And the following, who are the Amru Lei? Now, if you go to standard translations, when it says here, the Rabbi Yeshua Baravidi, Ikla Levei Rav Ashi, Bei is Bayit. But the standard translations will tell you to the school of Rav Ashi. Well, to my mind, that doesn't work. All right, because then it says they made from him. In other words, you come to the school of Rav Ashi, and then they cook this delicacy for you. So I am going to say, and I'll give you my evidence in a moment, I'm going to say that they actually visited the home of Rav Ashi. Let me tell you right now why I'm saying that, and then I'll just go down the story and make sure we get it according to this interpretation. It's the home of Rav Ashi because people have written, scholarship now holds that you didn't have a JTS back in the Talmudic period with walls and ceilings and bricks and mortar and so on. There were disciple circles. A rabbi had his students, and his students would come to his home and sit in his living room, or if you don't like living room, that's a retrojection onto the past, or sit at his table and have halachic discussions, or they would go with the rabbi on the road, or they would go on a ship with the rabbi, Yonina. We actually have many stories of that sort. They would go, as you probably famously know, they would go to the bathhouse with the rabbi, plus a rabbi's students, not today at JTS, but a rabbi's students were very much like his servants. So if you needed a towel, your student would give you a towel. If you wanted somebody to hang up to put your shoes out in front of the door, to shine your shoes, you gave it to your student. It seems there was this arrangement that I'll come study with you. I won't pay you any tuition, but in exchange for studying with you, I will behave as your student / servant. So going back to this story here, when they come to the home of Rav Ashi, his home is his Beit Midrash, and I can't be sure because it's usually women who do the cooking, so I'm going to guess that it's women or kitchen staff who prepared that delicacy. And then the question is, Amrule, so who's saying to the visiting rabbi, have a taste? And then he responds, I'm in a fast. And then the next line is, but don't you hold the teaching of Rav Yehuda? Well, there are two possibilities here. Either we say that the wife and the kitchen staff, overhearing plenty of rabbinic conversations, they themselves are spouting halakha, the way the wife of Rav Ashi in the previous episode did. So it could be the household staff and the wife who are having this little dialogue. And by the way, hospitality is very important. Do you realize how insulting it is? You go out of your way to prepare special food for guests, and what does the guest say? Not today. It's not that it's not kosher. It's not that I'm allergic. It's not that I'm vegan. It's just not today. Today, ani yoshev b'tani. So this rabbi, by the narrator, is being criticized, I am sure. All right? But I cannot tell you. I strongly suspect that he's engaging in dialogue here with knowledgeable household staff, including the rabbi's wife. But it could be that some of those household staff are doubling as the rabbi students, or the rabbi students are doubling as household staff. All right? So, again, I'm just going to sum up because we have 2 minutes left. I have examined, there are 150, it's actually 162, but I'm rounding it off. There are 150 anecdotes in the Babylonian Talmud, as I say, none in the Jerusalem Talmud, different term, in the Babylonian Talmud where you have this verb ikla, and I'm up to around 88. And in episode after episode, what's happening is rabbi comes to town, and either to a town or to another rabbi's house, does something, there's a halakha, rabbi fulfills the halakha, gets criticized for the way he fulfilled the halakha, and then defends his performance of the halakha, and the outcome is that a new halakha has just emerged. And when I say new halakha, I don't mean brand new halakha. I mean the halakha that was already promulgated, the halakha that's already on the books, has been modified by in the discussion, in the conflict between the visiting rabbi and the host rabbi. It's actually an excellent conflict because what it led to is expansion of the halakha. You might even say liberalization of the halakha, because almost invariably the guy who's being criticized is taking liberties with the halakha. I mean, you saw a few examples here. I would have to show you a lot more to convince you of that fact. But my summary statement is, whoever put together the Talmud, I think, is giving us an extremely important message by putting these little episodes, you know, every 2-3 pages. See, when you study Talmud line by line by line, what I call vertical fashion, you don't hit these episodes all that often. When you do hit them, you know, they don't make a big deal. They don't make a big impression. So, you know, you keep going. But I'm doing a horizontal study of Talmud right now, looking at episode after episode after episode, and knowing that, generally speaking, as I mentioned in the beginning, oh, these are such pious rabbis, they're carrying out the halakha. Well, yes, they are carrying out the halakha, but they're carrying out the halakha and modifying it a little bit to meet real life needs. And I think the ingenuity of the redactor who presents the halakha every couple of pages and then associates it with one of these little halachic anecdotes, which I'm calling neither prescriptive nor agadic, but descriptive halachic anecdotes, there's a brand new message, I think, coming out of all of this, which is you sit around and you figure out the halakha and the Beit Midrash, and then you try it out. And when you try it out, you know, on the people or on yourself, then you discover, I have to make certain changes. So to me, this is a very important message of the Babylonian Talmud for us as rabbis even today. Shalom.